And we did the asana. Didn't we? So number 36, arranging the Lord's hair. Didn't we do that? Yeah. Oh no, we discussed that. Vijitra Pushpa.
We went past dressing. We went past dressing.
We discussed about the hair and all that, right? But did we discuss about the colored belts and about... Okay, 37. Offering variously colored clothing, belts, turbans, capes, and so on. Divya Vastra. Then Krishna Kshetra Prabhu writes, there are many descriptions of Lord Krishna and his way of dressing. You can take advantage of such descriptions as well as styles from different temples for dressing and ornamenting the deities. Dress and ornament designed for deities is, of course, an art in itself, best learned from experts. So the basic thing is we try to dress Krishna, you know, closely like the descriptions that are there. He wears dhoti, he wears cheddar, you know, he has his mukuts and all that, but... Basically, you have dhoti and chadar, or they have these, you know, he sometimes wears these very long shirts with kind of like, you know, pants, and or sometimes we see like Radharaman, he wears in the summertime when it's hot, these shorts, like that kind of thing. So we should try to stick to what is more traditional, because these are things that Krishna himself likes to dress. Now the individual... How they put this together, how they nicely put the feathers and flowers and cheddars and ornaments and all that, then that is up to the, you know, ability of the individual devotee who is dressing the deities and all. So that is, in that way then, there's unlimited ways that one can perform this activity. But the basic principle is that Krishna wears dhoti, he wears cheddar, he wears a belt, and he wears a turban. This is the Nectar of Devotion mentions that Krishna always wears these four cloths. You know, the dhoti, the belt. The belt means that the dhoti on its own is considered not fully dressed. And when you, with the belt is there, belt means a cloth that goes around the waist. You know, it doesn't mean, you know, a leather belt with a you know, brass buckle on it. You know, but it means. Means a cloth that's put around the waist in, you know, some way or another. Then 38 is, which is the continuation of this, offering the Lord a crown, Muktam Mahat. Srila Prabhupada writes in his Nectar Devotion, his helmet, his earrings, his necklace, his four garments, the bangles on his head, the rings on his fingers, his ankle bells, and his flute. These are the different features of Krishna's ornaments. So we see here, yeah. So helmet is there, then the earrings, his necklaces that he'll wear, his four garments, which is what we just mentioned. The dhoti, the belt, the chadar, and the turban. So the helmet, see, in the tradition is that you had a turban, and then in the turban you put various pieces, like that. So if you actually look at what we call the mukut, or a crown, that we just put on and there's no turban, right? If you look at it, you'll always see a small kind of like triangular shape with a little bit round on the bottom. You'll always see that in those, like that. Now they have some other designs that don't have, but your really traditional pieces, they always have that in there. That's because... On the turban, many times they would put a piece on the head that you could put all these pieces into, and the turban would go around that. So somehow or another, then they started this thing where without the turban, you could put on the crown pieces, you know, on their own. Normally you had the turban and you fit all these pieces into it. But then they developed this kind of crown that without all that, you can just take it in one piece, put it on. You know, an example of the same kind of, how you say, concept is that you have a dhoti. It's a flat dhoti, and someone who knows how to wear it can put it on. There's some people who have no idea how to put on a dhoti, but they have to wear a dhoti for certain occasions, you know, like a big wedding or something like this. And it's, you know, it's probably, in their life they'll wear it only a few times. So you have shops that sell fancy dhotis that are sewn together so you can just put them on like a pair of pants and like kind of like pull some strings and make it tight. I've seen them. I've seen many people show up at these big weddings or yagyas with this kind of dress. I have no idea how to put on a dhoti. So it just makes life easier, you know, just quickly. You just put it on, you don't have to bother, and that's it. So in the same way, it's just with time, pujaris are not so interested in taking all the time to put on a mukut, so then they just put on a crown. It's easier, right? Means this is for Krishna's style of dress, like that. In Vaikuntha, you see they wear big crowns. The Vaikuntha, you know, it's kind of worship. It's a helmet with on its own is sitting, like that. You know, they have these, you know, chakras in the back and, you know, so many things. You look at the, you know, old Indian paintings, you'll always see them. So that's generally a complete thing. It's also known as Kirita. I think it's the name. It's a complete crown. It's like it sits on the head. Like that. But here is generally mukut pieces means that it's, you have the turban and these pieces fit in and you can put them in various ways and put the turban on in various ways, like, yes.
You're talking about pieces, is that the end of the cloth or something?
No, it means you put on the turban and then you have various jari pieces and they generally have a big pin in them and you stick them into the mukut. So before you would have like a triangular piece you'd put on that those things could stick into, you know, rather than sticking them into the top of your head or something. You know, it's easier, less painful. You understand or you didn't understand? Means if you have a mukut piece and it has a long pin on it, you can either poke it into your own head so it stands up straight, or you wear something else on top of the head that you poke it into.
Okay, yeah.
So which of the two is easier? The mukut are the pieces that you put into the turban. The turban is the cloth itself.
Yeah.
Like that. And then, or you can call here it says mukutam mahat. Then that is, you know, it may mean the whole thing. I'm not sure if exactly the word mukut means the whole thing, or it means just the pieces. But they'll call them, you know, in English, mukut pieces. I mean, they'll say mukut pieces, and the mukut means without the turban. The turban's already built in jari. You know? You'll see, there's something in there, it goes around the head, it's got that triangular piece in it, and then they've got all the other pieces connected. If you look at it in the design, you'll see it. They've taken the various mukut pieces, put them together in patterns, to simulate if it was in a turban, like that. I mean, this was all, the history of this was explained by some of the Mukutwalas in Vrindavan, saying that this is a newer development where you have the Mukut pieces put together as a crown that you don't have to deal with a turban, like that. You know, how long it's been there, I don't know, but it's, like if you look at all the paintings of Krishna, he's always got a turban on. Because Prabhupada says here, it's four garments. So one of the garments is the turban. But in the turban, they can have, you know, the helmet could be inside. That's that one part inside. Like sometimes you'll even see the Kshatriyas. They put on a helmet, and then they put a turban on around that. So only the top of the helmet sticks out. Like that, you know. Like that. So, I mean, you get these various kind of things, because you can do a lot more with the turbans. You know, you can make them in different ways, and you know, all kinds of amazing stuff you can do. While with the crown, it's pretty limited. Huh? Yeah, you can do more with them, like that. You know, more personalities there. Okay. So basically, depending upon your abilities and facilities, then you can do more elaborate dressing, less elaborate dressing. Even you find I don't know if they still have the standard, but in New York, I think New York, Los Angeles, they would change, they would do 2-day dresses. Huh? They don't do it in... They do. I know LA, definitely they were doing it. I think New York, they were doing it, but I don't know if they still do it. But they would put on one dress in the morning, and then when they close at noon, then they would put another dress. But they open later to do that. You know, they'll have to open at 5. They can't open at 4. So then, that's one. But otherwise, then generally there's a day dress you put on in the morning, and then at night, then you put on a night dress, something more comfortable with no ornaments and no jewelries and all that. And then, yeah. Okay, he makes a point here, Krishna Kshetra, that if a crown or other ornaments slips out of place during the darshan, then rather than just going up and fixing it, you should close the curtains. Fix it and then open the curtains again. In other words, things that you deal directly with the deity, touching the deity, it's best that these are not seen publicly, because many times you'll find in the, you know, those who come for darshan, their faith may not be so strong, so firm. So when you go up and you start doing these things, it kind of like breaks their meditation. And then they may not think as nicely about the deity, or they start thinking about you instead of the deity. You know, so many things, just it distracts the attention. So the best thing is that if you find the crown has slipped or something is gone or like that, you close the curtain, fix it, and then open it again. You know, you don't have to blow the conch, you know. Like that, it's because it's only for a moment. You ring the bell, you know, and then close the curtain, and come out, ring the bell, and then open it, you know, so they know it's going to happen. You know, unless it's just before an artik, you figure it out. You may close and then fix it. Then you'd blow the conch. Okay. Yeah, but if it's some adjustments on the altar, that you don't necessarily, minor adjustments, you don't necessarily have to close the curtains. You know, you just bring something out. Some little thing has happened. The picture's fallen over, you straighten it up. Or you bring a few flowers or anything like that. But if it's something major, then that's better to close. 39. Offering Gandha again and decorating the Lord's body with tilak designs. Divya Gandhanu Lepana. So it says here, when it's convenient, then you can draw these designs on the Lord's body. With Gandhanu Lepana means with Gandha, generally with sandalwood paste, with, you know, whatever, some things in it. Lepana means like to smear, you know, to put, to draw like that. It means it's something wet that you are doing some work with. So then... So that means, you know, you can put on the forehead, on the cheeks, on the chin, on his arms or hands, on his legs, you know, wherever one, you know, depending upon the dress, what's exposed, like this, these can be put. So many different designs are there, many nice designs. So that can be done then. Means in the, here it's mentioned that after, you've offered all these different things. Yeah. So this is after resting and all that. Okay. Then offering Kustuba. Number 40 is offering Kustuba and other wonderful jewels. Kostubari Vibhushana. So he's saying, Krishna Kshetra Prabhu is saying here that the 38, where you're offering a crown, is mainly for the metal ornaments. while the Upachara 40 is wonderful jewels. Means primarily jewelry includes stones and lockets and other special, you know, probably rings and other things like that. You know, finer jewelries rather than the big major kind of like the Mukut, or if there's some other armbands or some other things like this, you know. But where you're putting on other things. Probably mentions here earrings, his necklace, his four garment, the bangles on his head, the rings on his fingers, his ankle bells and his flute.
What does it mean by bangles on his head?
I'm just thinking what that means. Must mean that there's like little necklaces and things that you put on the turbans and stuff like that. Yeah, because generally you think of bangles that are on the wrists. But it... not sure. Okay, 41. Offering varieties of flowers and garlands. Vichitra Divya Pushpa. Along with flower garlands, you may also offer a tulsi garland to the Lord. In the afternoon, after waking and dressing the Lord, you may decorate him with fresh garlands and decorative flowers. So it's like in the afternoon when the deities wake up, then you can always put changed flowers or changed garlands, if anything, especially if they've wilted or, you know, they've gotten, you know, they've lost the smell, or, you know, you have the, you know, opulence of having enough flowers that you can offer again, you know, in quantity like this. But especially like some flowers you may offer in the morning, and by the noon or after they've rested, you see they've wilted and that they don't have a good appearance, so they could be changed at that time. But other ones that are good through the whole day, then that's not a problem. Mm-hmm. Like many flowers, they always last. But some flowers, they're, you know, very nice for a few hours and they wilt. Any questions up to here? Because now after this, we've basically gone through the 15 of the 16 items. And then the last is the concluding activities, which includes a lot of, you know, fine points, but then many of them are repeats of previous major items done at various times of the day or in a smaller way. Yes. Which one? 41.
And 28 on page 102. So the same name except it's one letter longer than the 41.
What's it? 22.
102, page 102, item number 28.
Oh, item number 28. See, this is the first, this is in the major 16 that you're going through now, but he didn't mention the thing, is he should have gone through and showed them, but... because this is the main one. These are the 28 will be your main garlands and things like this. This is offering variety, means you may put some other ones afterwards, and then in the evening you may put... See, this is being described... means Hari Bhakti Vilasa is describing here the 64 items, but throughout the day, and very much in a system that's, one understands the culture and everything, and is all the activity, means the full-time pujaris are acting and doing everything all around the deity. So what's happening here is this: the Lord is gone from the altar, means. If we look at this technically, what's going on? Then you're going, he's going from the altar to a special place. the worship is going on there. You're doing all this main, you're doing the bathing there, the dressing, the ornamenting. You're offering artik, you're offering him bhoga. All right? So we've gotten through the 15 of the 16 items. Right? Then you're taking to a place to rest. He rests a little bit, and then after resting, you know, it's not long rest. You know, it just means, you know, just little sitting and all that. Then after that, then he's going to get ready now for the darshan. You understand? Means he's gone for his bath. He's, you know, been decorated in that. There's been some worship. He takes his meal. You know, he's been kind of received on by the inside group of devotees. Some worship is there. He has his meal. Then he rests a little bit. Then after that, then he's going to go out into the public. You understand? So before going in the public, then you can put some nice designs, put some other garlands, you know, like that. You can, you know, arrange the hair a little bit. You know, do some other things. In other words, before the meal, in other words, like if you're in an informal setting, you don't dress up as much. So you've done the bathing and all that. You've dressed him. He's got his dhoti and chadar on. You know, he's got a garland on. He may have something a little bit, you know, this and that. And he eats a little something and does a little resting. But then before going for the main, you know, well, he'll meet others and go out into the public. He'll leave the house and go out. The residents of Vrindavan will see him and all that. Then he'll dress up some more. So there'll be the same kind of worship again without the bath, but more of it. You know, a little more flowers, a little bit more, maybe some other garlands, you know, more on doing on the turban and all that, draw little designs on his, you know, face or on his arms. And, you know, it means now he becomes very presentable. Right? Then, you'll see in the next part here, concluding activities, is then he goes back to the throne. Then he gives darshan and all that kind of stuff. You understand? Then it goes back to the formal. Right? In other words, we started with the formal, went into the bathing and dressing and all these, which is informal, kind of like on the inside. Then he comes back out again into the formal again. You understand? This is what's happening. So previously the temples were designed for this. You had the deity room, the big deity room, and depending upon your deity, then either the main deity or the Utsav Murtis, they would move around and go to different rooms and do different things. Right? So you have your big deity, and then the Utsav, the small deity, then they would go to another room for bathing and this and that, and then go in another room and take the bhoga, another room for resting, do a little bit more of this and that, and then you bring them back later. You know, one is that time was there, more time may be given, or two, people were much more expert. So while somebody's dressing and dealing with the big deity for darshan, the small deities would be going and doing all these other things. You understand? So this kind of worship was, you know, going on. You know, this is, in other words, this is how they were perfecting themselves. Because if you know the pastimes, how they move like that. You understand? Krishna gets up, you know, he's received, then he takes his bath, they dress him, this and that. He comes, he eats, takes his meal, then he goes and rests on one veranda of the house with Balaram. You know, they chew some pan and all that. And then after that, then they'll come out, and then they'll go out and meet the residents of Vrindavan, and then go to the forest. You understand? So these things, this is what goes on in Vrindavan, in the spiritual realm. But they regulate this, you know, like this. So Krishna likes doing things in this way, like that. But he just, because we don't know how to do that, we don't have that spontaneous love that we naturally, you know, do these things or are allowed to assist those who are doing these things. Then it's turned into regulation. It's just seen how much you want to please the Lord. We want to please more than those residents. They take us in. We're attached to the rules and that. Then that's another thing. Or we're not at all. It's just something to do. Then, like that. So accordingly, then the devotees will deal with this. The Lord will reciprocate. Is that understood? You understand why it's moving in this way? So in our temples, then generally you just see that whatever goes on here, it's reduced down. means, in other words, not reduced down means it's how do you say, folded back into each other. Like those two times of offering garlands and flowers are put into one. You know? Or like he suggests, you can get that second one by in the afternoon when you wake up the deities, you know, at 3:30 in the afternoon, as you take that as the rest. Because you'll see, after eating, he rests. So in the morning, you offer him the little fruit and this and that, he rests a little bit. You know, like that. And then after the lunch, you'll rest again. So you can apply that in the morning puja, or you can apply that after the lunch. You understand? In other words, these kind of things are so perfect that they can many times apply to many situations. One description is there, but that can be applied in many different ways. You understand? So for us, we will apply it in this way. That's why Krishna Kshetra mentions it in this way. In the afternoon, after waking and dressing the Lord, you may decorate him with fresh garlands and decorative flowers. Therefore, you get the second one. Otherwise, in that old system, is that the deity, before going back to the altar for darshan, like that, then they may decorate him again. You understand? Like that, you put some of the decoration on before, and then you put more on after. That, but that just takes more time, more skill. You know, the arrangements have to be more. You know, if one's temple is having enough trouble just, you know, finding pujaris to get the deity doors open on time, then you don't bother like this. You can apply it in this other way. You understand? Just like brushing the teeth, it can be upon waking the deity, or it can be after the Mangalartik, as preliminaries to snan. Right? It can either be put in the Jagran Seva when you wake the deity. You wake him up, then, you know, brush his teeth, wash his mouth, wash his feet, hands and feet. Then offer him a little bit, you know, take him to the altar, offer a little boga. You know, and then there's Mangalarti. Or you just wake him up, they go to the altar, they have the meal, you know, like that. And then he goes, and then after Mangalarti, then when he goes to the bathing, then he brushes his teeth. You understand? So like that, here these items can be adjusted, but you have to understand how they're functioning, what's the culture of it, and then it can be applied. Means formal means it's more public, or it's more just formal, meaning more ritualistic. Yeah, means that first situation where you asanam swaganam padya margya machmaniya madhupaka punarachman, that's formal. You know, even if it's in the informal place, but that is like you're receiving him. That's a formal reception. I mean, that's top of the line. You don't get better than that. You know? Like that. You can add more finer things to it. You know, means you can do a reception with 10 items. Means, let us say you're doing, we don't get into this so much, because then you identify the seats very strongly, which the Gaudiya Vaishnavas don't do so much. They know the situations, but they don't put overemphasis on the seat, the asan. You know, these five kinds of asans. They don't put an overemphasis on it, so that whole idea is you come to an asan, you can do a full worship there, right? To receive him at the asan, then do the function of the asan. You understand? So sometimes it looks like double things are going on. You understand? Or you'll drop off the things that would be doubled. Like you're bringing him to the first asan, which is called mantrasana. Means so there padya margyam asanam swaganam padya margyam achmaniyam madhuparka punarachman, right? But because he's come to that seat, then you worship him at that seat. So you may do ganda pushpa dup deep naivedya, right? You offer incense, lamps, flowers, you know, scents and boga, because he's come to the mantrasana. So you worship him, you do those things, plus that five of worship. Then he goes to the snanasana, then you receive him there with asavanam, swagatam, pardyam, argyam, achmaniyam. You know, you don't do the madhuparka and punarachman again. So he's just done that, but that was in the mantrasana. Now you've moved him to where he's going to bathe, you receive him there. It means you received him at the formal place, and that is the worship. Is receive. In other words, part of the 16 items is formally receiving him. You know? And then you can add on to that those aspects of worship. Like, you know, there's reception, bathing, dressing, and worship. Right? So then when you're receiving him, you can also worship him. Then you go to the place for bathing, you receive him again, you know, without the madhuparka and the punarachman, and then you do the bathing. Then he can move to the place where he's being dressed, you can receive him again. You know, asanam, you're moving to a new place, so it's asanam, swagatam, and then padyamargyam achmaniyam. Right? And then he could be worshipped for coming there. Then, on that asana, then he'll be worshipped. Right? Then you'll offer Ganda Pushpa Dup Deep Naivedi, but that'll be in a bigger thing. Understand? When he goes to the Bhojasana for bathing, means that where they dress is the Alankarasana. Snanasana, Alankarasana. Then when he goes to the place for eating, then you receive him. So there you don't have to do as elaborate. There's Padyam and Achmaniyam. He's received there. But you can do. You can also do. Then, you understand? So it's like each time he moves to the asana, you can do worship him with 10 items. You know, or adjust with what's there on the asana. But that is specifically for Vaikuntha worship, where you make such a to-do out of each asana. That's how the Vaikuntha worship becomes more elaborate. They don't do anything more than we're doing. Don't worry. The Shris, the Madhvas, this, they're not doing any ritual that we ourselves don't do. Just that they do certain ones of them many, many times. And other things are simple, and some of the things that we do more, put emphasis on that more, and they put less. Like you see, we put more emphasis on dressing the deities. And you go to any other temple, they don't dress the deities as much as we dress. They don't put as much cloth and as many things as we put. Some will put a lot of ornaments, you know, like that. But dress is not a whole lot. They just put a simple dhoti and a cheddar and that's it, you know. You understand? So for us, we don't make as much to do from that. There's a much more smooth flow from when you receive him to his bathing. It's just, you know, you don't sit in the same place where you bathe and for when you receive somebody, and you don't dress in the same place you bathe. So the deity is just moved, but we don't make a big to do out of that each time. It's more just him as a person going through this, you know. He bathes, he dresses, you know, he takes a little something to eat. And then he rests a little bit, and then you decorate some more, and then he's going to go out to the public. Like that. So there's much more of a smooth flow. That is the aspect of the Vrindavan worship. So the Vaikuntha worship will follow the same padati, the same principles. Just every time he moves from, you know, one spot to another, then there'll be a whole worship done again. Does that make some sense? Like that. That's why once you know the 16 items, you know deity worship. Right? But you just have to know how much they can expand and how they're put together. You know, what combinations go with what. You know? You have asana, the kinds of asanas, what other aspects go with the asana. You know, when the achman is used, when the padyam is used. You know? Like that. When the dressing aspects of the dressing and ornamenting and all those are used, when the worship is used. So they can all be used more in different times of the day for different occasions and all that. That's the whole point. But there's only 16 items. Does that make some sense? Right? So one can always bring Ija back to 16. Means the worship back to 16. Right? And then the breakup of the worship is all of the whole ash concept of Pancharatra is always in five. Panchanga. You have the Abhigamana, the Upadhyaya, Abhigamana, approaching the temple. Upadana, collecting the items. Yoga, which is preparing oneself and the paraphernalia, the consciousness. Ija, which is the worship, means the 16 items. And the Swadhyaya, or the study and practice and training of others in the process of devotional service and the deity worship. All right? Means what we're doing now is Swadhyaya. Like that. It's part of the training. We're studying it. Like that. Then we're going to do it. So this is all part of Swadhyaya. Yes?
For example, when you do this decoration with something like this, that would be an expression of Gandha.
Yes. It would be part of Gandha. There'll be an expansion of that. You see, everything is expansion of that, or sometimes they're kind of a mix because certain things go together like that. But that would be an expansion of that. Like now, offering artik. So artik is you know, a combination of dup, deep, and means, in other words, it's an aspect of the worship. Like that. You know, it's a function of the alankar asana. You know, that situation. Now, what you offer the artik with, how much it is, the different times of the day, that's another thing, you know. But that is all an expansion of when in the puja you offer the incense, you offer the lamp, like that. You understand? So that is number 42, like that. But because this is being done in here, this is also then within concluding activities. They're taken from there, but this has its own function. Now we've discussed now very seriously the 15 of the 16 items, like that. Now the 16th item is concluding activities. So these end activities, now is where you're going to, the Lord will be seen by the devotees. Now he comes public, and all the various kinds of worship that aren't done privately in the deity room are now performed, right? Like that. Those are being performed now. So even though they may have aspects like the other 15, but they have a different thing, because now it's being your worship. In other words, you're worshiping the Lord now along with the devotees. Then you're worshiping the Lord through mantra. You're worshiping the Lord through fire, through the yajna. You're circumambulating, you're offering yourself, you're distributing the prasadam, you're offering prayers, offering obeisances. You understand? These are all part of that. So you have some activities like the preliminary. You know, we did Purvanga Karma. It's before you actually start the 16. Though within that it has, because Mangalartik is part of it. Right? Mangalartik technically is part of attending Mangalartik, at least is technically part of Abhigamana. Right? Cleaning the temple, this and that. But then we see again Artik is there, here at the Darshan, but that's considered now part of the 16th. Like that. Just make some... These are very fine points, because they have a different flavor to them, a different mood. You know? So that's the thing about Pancharatra, is understanding the fine points. Understand how they connect together. You know? Because they have different functions. You know, it's just like one may say, well, it's so complicated or this or that. Why not simple? But even in Western culture, you have so many things. You know, it's just like you have on your table setting, right? You have, you know, two or three forks and two or three spoons and so many knives and, you know, different napkin, different glasses, different, because they serve different functions. Like that. You know, saying just, you know, you just like what you wear in the summer, what you wear in the winter. Like in the summer, you generally light clothes, more towards cotton, brighter colors. Winter, it'll be heavier clothes, it'll be things that are warm, darker colors, more plain, not so many design. You know, one may say, well, this is very complicated. How do I understand this? But the main thing is by association. People who already know this, you associate with them, then you learn this. That's the, you know, Vedic. I mean, it's the way anything works. Someone who's actually doing it, you associate with them, do it with them, you then take on the same qualities. You can't just by reading the book. Like Krishna Kshetra points out in the beginning of the book, this book is not a do-it-yourself manual. Like that. You can't have a do-it-yourself manual in deity worship. You have something that documents all the activities that go on, all your mantras, all the philosophy and understandings, so that, and your procedures, so that you know, you can always study it and see that you're following the standard, you know. And by reading it, one can gain a lot of knowledge, you know, the swadhyaya, but one must practice it also. That's where you get. Like, that's why swadhyaya, see, in the West, study means you just sit down with the book and read it, and that's it, you know. So you may have a test on it, you know, or like that. But in the Vedic, swadhyaya means you'll read it, you'll practice it, and once you know how to do it, you'll teach it to others. Okay? So then they're learning. In other words, you go to someone who's already done their swadhyaya, and now they're on the aspect of the studying of the studying aspect. They've practiced. Now they're teaching you. So they're on the teaching part, you're on the hearing part. Right? Then you start practicing under their direction. So you're practicing and hearing. Then you come to the point, now you teach it to the next. And then the next generation comes in and they start their swadhyaya with hearing from you. You understand? So it's a natural, it's a complete process. It not only does it ensure proper standard, but it also ensures that there is carrying on of the tradition. Right? Does that make some sense? Yes? No? Like that. So in other words, it's a very complete system. You know, it's like the moderns, you learn something, but there's no emphasis you have to teach it to anyone else, or you even have to practice it. Like you go to school, you go to 2 years of calculus, there's no obligation to practice it. It means the only time you use it is when you're sitting in the classroom. So if one individual decides they like this, and then in university, then go farther into it, you know, and then they may make a life out of it, right, an occupation out of it. But that's very much just the individual. So it's not really built into the system. But the Vedic system, it's built in. So the I is not complete without this. So it may take many years. You may be hearing for so long and practicing for so long, and then after some time you're teaching. You know? Or what you know is you're going along, someone comes and asks, and you teach just that part. You know? And you continue. So it's very dynamic, very alive. Like that. Is that understood?
Yeah. The question about that. Why is it that such an artificial system is built in the world? You know, like the maths, there's such a. The plethora of things that children learn at school, and you can see afterwards that they barely use. They may basically learn how to count and.
That's it. I mean, I'm speaking from experience. I like math. Yeah. I went through 2 years of calculus, yeah. But since you know you get out of school, I haven't had to use any of it since. You know, it's like a rare case. Sometimes they have to count. Yeah. You know, I mean, generally counting is this. You know. As you know, technical as you get. Sometimes you have to add. You know, I mean, rare I ever have to multiply. I mean, divide, multiply. I use a little bit more, adding and multiplying. Sometimes subtracting, and division very rare. And then you know, forget about algebra, geometry, trigonometry, and calculus. I mean, it's like you know, how do you use it? You know. That's a whole another thing. That's the theory of education. But the basic thing is that if you go back in history, you'll find that even the European, it was closer to the Vedic. The whole idea is someone who is cultured, then they learned certain things. They learned language, they learned, you know, math and medicine and astrology and this. But they learned it in a practical way, you know. And astrology and this, but they learned it in a practical way. You know, they learned Latin, but then their classes were going on in Latin. They were studying, their books were in Latin. You know, they were doing, you know, so many different things, and then they would study all these things, and like you would learn the histories, and then you would you would, your values would be based on those histories. You know, before it was you had history. Today's values were built on the values in the past, and you were supposed to learn from those. You learn the qualities, you learn the different things from those. So the tradition would carry on. So then one was considered like cultured and educated, because he knew something, it was practical, he could use it. Like that. In the end, we're just talking in the intellectual field. Skilled trades and guilds and that were always going on. It means that you learned under somebody who was a master in the field, in the art, and then after some years you became a master. You know? So if you start when you're 6 or 8, by the time you're 18, 20, you're a master. So then you would do it, and then you would teach. Naturally, these ones, it still goes on. I think even now, those who are into skilled trades and that, this process is much more alive. But somehow the intellectual field, it disconnected itself kind of from the practicalities of life, kind of. Probably due to the concept that everybody should go to school. You know, well, before it was those who had real good ability in academics went to that line. Those who didn't went into skills, into trades, like that. It was just, they were practical. You know, it's either you go to school and by the time you're, you know, into your 20s or something, then you'll be able to practically use that. You come out, you can teach others, you can do so many different things. You know, people come to you for astrology or medicine or, you know, something practical like that. Or you went to the skilled trades and by the time you're 18, 20 or 16 or whatever it is, you're a master in your field and you're doing it already. So the culture is, but now it's like you go through the school and it's not. And they've decided everyone should study this long. You know, there's always rules. Everyone's got to study until they're 18 or 16 or 15 or 14. Different countries have different standards. So now, if you actually look at it, there's not that much that you really use in day-to-day life, and it wouldn't take that much to teach. If you took whatever you practically use, you know, and you take that 12 years of education or 16 years of education, and you take it, then the 12 years of education, what you practically use, you could probably teach an adult in a very short time, 1-2 years. You know? It wouldn't take long to teach them at all. And since you've made a rule to keep everyone busy until they're 18, then you have to, it means just the basic stuff will be finished much before that. Generally by the time you're 12, you've finished anything that you're going to really use regularly in your life. You know? I mean, it's just like, any novel or generally any textbook or anything like that is written for, I forget what it's called. They have 15 levels of complexity of writing. I think it's 15. 15 or 12. And so the normal thing is something like 7 or 8. That means a 12-year-old. You know, like you see that they're reading, it's reading material for 12 plus. You know? Like that means by the time you're 12, you have the basic vocabulary, understanding, reading ability to read the same book that, you know, a 40-year-old's going to read. Maybe the 40-year-old's developed a little more vocabulary, right? But unless that older person is really into language, where they develop some really serious skills, they're not going to learn a whole lot more, right? Need more, excuse me. Learn is nothing, but need much more, right? So, but since you still have another 6 years to go, so you have to fill it up with something. Therefore, they just keep redoing. If you see the curriculum of all the grades, you'll see they're doing the same thing over and over and over and again. You know, like they teach magnetism about 3 times to the kids, you know, and they teach, you know, so many different things over and over again. Because, you know, you learn that you have to do something when they're 5 years old, right? You know, so then, you know, they've already forgotten about magnetism, you know. So then you have to teach them again when they're 8, you know, and then again when they're, you know, 10 or 12. Like that. You know, it's just they have to fill the time. Like that. Yes, and that way it becomes artificial. Like that. It means that a child who has very good academic ability, then it's good training is not so much the subjects they learn, but the ability to sit down, concentrate, write, study, listen to the teacher, take part in you know, discussions, or you know, be able to speak, you know, present. You know, these are the kind of things that actually they'll use. The subject matter they may use, may not use. So it's like they've learned these skills, you know, how to sit down for an hour, 2 hours, do homework, study. These are the things they'll use. What they studied, they may never use again in their life. Right? So the Vedic concept, they try to do it that what you study, what you do, none of it is ever left out or thrown out. It's not small. In other words, you take adult education, you figure out which parts of it are simple. Right? There's things an adult has to know that are pretty simple. Right? Isn't it? Yeah, like that. An adult has to know it. That means you go to a new country, you learn a language, you're going to have to learn those things anyway. You know? Like that. So the idea in the Vedic culture is you take those things which a small child could learn from adult education and teach that to the small children. And then those things in which, you know, a young teenager could use, you teach it to them. Those things that a young man can use, you could understand, you teach that part to them. And those who needs more maturity, then you teach that to them. And those who take the same thing, but you just take out the parts and give it. So it's never artificial. Just like you have, I don't know, at least in English you have, you know, you have all these funny rhymes and other funny little poetries, and you know, Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, you know. You'll never use it in your life, you know. I mean, absolutely, there's not a forum you'll use it for in your life except for to teach the next little kid, you know, to keep him busy, you know. But in the Vedic culture, you won't have that. It means what you teach to the little kids, that'll be stuff they'll use when they get big. A small kid, their memory is like a trap. Anything you put in, it just catches. So anything you want them, you want an adult to have memorized, they teach it to the little kids. They may understand, it may not, but because their mind's like a trap and they're spaced out and they couldn't care less, you know, they just learn it. They're too young to ask, what do I need this for? You know, this is stupid. They don't ask that. You teach that to them. Then when they start getting to the age where they're going to say, well, what's this for? That's when you start teaching them the next step. What is it for? And then you teach them the basic aspects that at that age they can understand what it's for. You know, like some ritual, some other things like that. Then when they hit more maturity, they hit 16, where their actual brain starts to work, then you can teach them the purposes, the philosophy, the, you know, especially purposes and those things behind it, and beginnings of philosophy. And then as they get more mature, then you can get into the deep esoteric aspects of the philosophy. In other words, the Vedic concept, you teach all the memory stuff, you teach all the technical stuff. Means technical means non-intellectual, right? Then you start teaching the technical intellectual stuff, right? And then you get into the esoteric. Does that make some sense? So you take the same body of subject, but you break it up like that, and then you teach it to the different ages. So nothing is a waste. Therefore, in the Gurukul system, when they say you go to school for 12 years, 12 years means from zero to PhD. Right? Because they've broken it up like that, and they waste no time. They don't teach you three times about magnetism. You know? Understand? They know when to teach it, so that you only have to teach it once, and then you understand its use. Does that make some sense? Like that. Besides that, this is another aspect. The main emphasis is on the culture. Because someone who has knowledge should have a culture with it. This is where you have similarity before. Is that the whole idea of going to school and becoming educators to become cultured. Right? That was the whole purpose. You went to become a gentleman. So gentlemen knew Latin, knew Greek, knew all the, you know, Greek and Roman mythologies, and, you know, they knew, you know, some medicine, some astrology, you know, like this. They knew some geography, right, you know, and that they considered that was a gentleman knew these things. So then the person like that could move in those circles, in educated circles. So, and how they would sit, how they would behave, how they would speak, how they would dress, all this would be taught to them. Right? But then with time, then it became disassociated. So the academics is purely academics, and they don't really bother about training of character and that. I mean, they hint at it, but there's no real obligation, you know? Yeah. Yeah, no real understanding. But so the Vedic thing, the emphasis was on developing character, because if you don't have character and you have knowledge, then you become dangerous. Right? If you don't have character and you don't have any, you know, brains, then, you know, other than, you know, breaking things or stuff like that, you can't do a whole lot of damage. You know? You can do some localized physical damage. But that's about it. But if you have brains and no culture, then you can create, you know, big problems. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you can create so much problem. Like, you see revolutions, this, that, they're all created with guys with brains but no character. You know? Like that. You look, many of the people in the West, Western philosophers and those who started these revolutions, if you look at their personal life, oh, it's terrible. You know? I mean, if you told somebody this is what they do, you know, you'd figure the guy should be, you know, locked up somewhere. You know, he's either crazy or he's just, you know, totally, you know, just not proper behavior, no proper morals. Like that. So the Vedic concept was is that culture was the most important aspect of the training. It had to balance, because the farther you take them academically, you have to take them farther in culture also. Otherwise it won't balance and you'll get pride. It's called Veda Garva, pride of knowledge. Like that. Veda Garva, Vidya Garva, like that. Garva means proud, become big, you know, puffed up, you know. Prabhupada used the word puffed up, you know, because it means puffed, you know, big, you know. Like that, like the frog, you know. They got such false ego. You go up to them and poke them, blow right up, you know. Like that, who are you, you know. They don't understand how big you are, yeah. So you're big enough to pick them up, check them out of the house, but somehow they don't know that. Yeah, so they just puff themselves up, you know. You know, like every bug that comes before them is wasted, you know, so they're the lord of all they survey, and then you come along and somehow upset their program, you know, like that. So, you know, that's the frog. That's why it's so much used, the frog in the well. Is connected with the intellectual who doesn't actually have proper culture or proper knowledge. You know? It's because that thing of puffing oneself up. You know, so somebody's puffed up. You know?
It's interesting, the point is that as a psychological changes in a person's change, the knowledge is faster.
Yes. That's the whole thing, is the Vedic concept is you're dealing with an individual. So as those changes come, you know, generally they come at certain ages, but you don't have to limit it specifically to the biological age. You look more at the mentality. You know, you have a 13-year-old, you may still deal with like a 10-year-old. You have a 10-year-old, you may have to deal with them like a 13-year-old. Yeah. In other words, you just look at the mentality. It means this mentality, this is taught. So whenever it comes, generally it'll come around 12, 13. But if it comes earlier or later, that's when they get it. You know, you don't just do it just by age.
That's the other problem with the Western education system, is that it's forced into a groove.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many defects in it. So many defects. I mean, many modern educators are understanding that it doesn't function very well. You know? And the systems they go back to are coming closer to the Vedic, you know, like that, because they work. Because the closer you get to the Vedic, the better it works. That's the, it means the material world's made by Krishna. And Krishna in the Vedas tells how the material world functions, you know, how to make it work properly. So the closer you come to that, the better it works, you know, like we discussed in the class. If you look at those people who are very successful materially and those who are not. Those who are not, then they have, their mind is scattered. So many desires, so many this, no determination, you know, no enthusiasm, like that. You know, no self-control. But you find those who are materially successful, self-control is there, the determination is there, the enthusiasm is there, that one-pointed intelligence is there. But it's for, instead of for Krishna, it's for Maya. So the principle works. You want to make something work, then you have to focus. You have to control your senses, you know, because you're going to have to put in the time and the energy, and you can't just do anything, right? You can't make money if all you do is spend the money on stupid things. You have to control yourself, not spend it, invest it, then you get return. You understand? So like that, it works. So these principles, these are principles. That's how a place works. So the closer you come to them, then it works. The difference being, though, because then you can say, well, then you can take anything. That's why we can go out and take anything from anywhere. That's, I mean, the Yukta Vairagya. So we can take the technique because we see how it's connected to the Vedic principle. You know? In other words, you know the principle, maybe we don't know a detail that's really practical. So you can see the karmis have a detail. It works. We can take that. But we take that what their working thing is, that you know, the working detail. We don't take the culture. We don't take their motive behind it. This is where one can make a great mistake. So in the West we may see so many practical things, but we have to take it without taking the culture. This is the example of the swan. You can give milk and water, the swan will take the milk, leave the water. Right? So the whole point is when we deal with these things, you may have to take, but we have our own culture.
Have a reason for having training in that culture.
Yes. Yeah. So that's the whole purpose of the Swadhyaya, is you're trained in the culture and this and that. Then how intelligent you can apply in so many situations. You only learn one quarter from a class of all of your knowledge. One quarter you'll learn from self-study. Right? One quarter you'll learn from others. And one quarter you'll learn from experience. This is how one learns. So one quarter of your knowledge only you can get in the classroom. You know? Like that. So these are the situations. You go out, others will tell you about, because they have their experiences, they tell you, you learn from them. Right? And then you yourself see. So you see and you apply, you use your intelligence and you adjust, you make it happen, make it work. But it's based on our own culture and the principles that we have learned. Like that. It means anything anyone's espousing nowadays, the principles of what make it work are coming from the Vedic things. They don't know that. I mean, that's what's there. But because they're not connecting to the Vedas, they don't have the culture. So therefore it has a totally different flavor and feel than those things that are coming from the Vedic culture. Right? And even within the Vedic culture, one has to, by understanding from the Acharyas, has to be able to take what is important for a devotee. Right? In other words, we may, like, we're learning the deity worship, but we're learning it in a particular mood. Right? The smartas will also learn the same things. The karmakandi will learn the same things. The jnanakandi will learn the same things. Right? The yogi will learn the same things. They have a totally different mood. You understand? So just as we go in to, we can take, you know, yukta vairagya means you engage anything from anywhere, but we don't take the culture, right, from the West. We take the things that work, the details that work, but we connect them back to the principles that Krishna's given us. That's, and so therefore, it connects back to Krishna, right? The same time as even within the Vedic sphere, we may take the rules and different aspects. We only take the mood that's given to us by the acharyas. We leave all the other moods. So therefore, the moods and purposes of the materialists in the non-Vedic sphere and the mood of the materialists in the Vedic sphere, both are dropped. You know, we only take the mood given to us by the acharyas. And we base all the principles in the Krishna conscious philosophy and culture and sadhana. And then we can take details from anywhere as long as we leave all those moods. Understand? You situate yourself in the Gaudiya Vaishnav, you know, mood and culture. And then for training, we can take from both the more from details from the Vedic and from the modern. But we connect them all back into the thing, into the, yeah, into the Vaishnava philosophy, right? Yes, that's then it's naturally, in other words, when you understand the principles, the details can be added. Otherwise, it's very dangerous. You see, anyone who gets into anything, modern or Vedic, without this understanding, is lost, guaranteed. I mean, you see people get into Sanskrit, we've lost so many Sanskrit pundits because they don't have the culture and the mood, you know. We've also lost those who get into Western knowledge and they become lawyers, they become Coveyites, they become, and they all disappear, you know. They all disappear because they took, along with the knowledge, they took the mood, the values, the modus operandi, and they're gone. Like that. Prabhupada says you have to be able to catch the fish without getting wet. Right? But they caught the fish, but now they live with the fish. You know? So it's very important. The central feature of the Gaudiya Vaishnav mood and culture and philosophy has to be the central feature of everything, because that's what you're going to connect anything into. If you can't connect it to that, don't touch it. Can't connect it to that, don't touch it. Because that's the essential. You have that, you have the subject. You don't have that, you may think you have the subject, but you don't. Because it's an illusion. Just like you go out, you have the tree, you have the shadow. You may say, I have the whole shadow. So what? Someone else has a little piece of the bark. You go, ah, you only have a little piece of the bark. I have the whole shadow.
Sanskrit expert in the wrong mood.
Yeah, you say big Sanskrit pundit. But if he doesn't know Krishna and doesn't know the culture, the proper Vedic culture, what its purposes are. You know, just like Prabhupada mentioned, you have these very pious gentlemen who every morning, without fail, do puja for a few hours. Right? You know, very qualified, pious people. But when a sadhu comes to visit him, like Prabhupada would go to visit him, or the sannyasi would go to visit him, he would make them wait. I'm doing my puja. You know, they've made a rule. Every day I do puja. When I finish my puja, only I will talk, I will eat, I will see people. You know, very pious. But that's okay if the people that are coming are just family members or, you know, family friends, you know, just other materialists. You know, you're just going to eat, you know, for your own son, all these things. But when a devotee comes, then the Lord, the injunction is you stop your puja and receive the devotee. You understand? Hear from him, because that's swadhyaya. It's also part of the deity worship. So they don't know the full deity worship. They know the technicalities and all that, but these other things, that's the mood of it. It means the Lord's devotee has come. The Lord is not going to be happy with you sitting there and ornamenting him and doing that when the devotee is sitting outside. The Lord would be more pleased you go out, receive the devotee, feed the devotee, take care. And when they're taken care of, then come back and finish the puja. Right? So therefore, all their knowledge really doesn't, on deity, doesn't really have any meaning. Because they don't know how to please. The point of deity worship is to please the Lord. Right? And in deity worship, you can't please the Lord if it's if you only see the Lord and not the devotees. You know, as Kapila Muni pointed out, those who just see me, then I don't take so seriously. Those who deal nicely with me and badly with my devotees, I can't take as a serious devotee. You know? Whatever. They're working on their level, but I don't consider them serious. You know, so much is there, but those things they won't catch. They'll only catch all the ritual things, you know, all the benefits by doing this, and you get this benefit by doing that. If you don't do this, you go to this hell, and do that, you lose all this, or like that. I can tell you that all day. But these actual ones that are the functioning principles of the Vaishnav culture, that they don't know. Right? They miss the essence. Though they may be doing the form, but they don't know the life of it, the soul of it. So that's the thing. So you start from the soul, like so you see, Prabhupada gave us the soul, and then expected us keeping that soul intact, then you can expand the form. But you see, many times, because the essence is sometimes so simple, you know? It's just like you take some cream off the milk, it's only a little bit, you know, and you give that to somebody. And you go, here, I have for you some cream. But after a while, then they look and go, yeah, but look at all that milk there. You know, they don't understand that you have the cream, you have the milk. You know? But now, if you want more, then you take, you know, that you have that, keep that cream, you can add some milk to it. But now what's happening is that one may foolishly, you know, set aside the cream and then just go for the skim milk. You know? And because one's attracted by so much volume, so much, you know, whatever it is, you know? Like that, then, you know, nice white color or whatever it is, you know? Like that, then you don't realize about the cream. Plus, there's no cream in it. You know? Or if it's there, you can't recognize it because it's mixed in. So only the expert knows how to get the cream out. You know, you boil the milk and it's set, or just let it sit and it'll float, come to the top, and you know, like this. You know, you have to know, otherwise, how you get, you won't get. So that's the whole point. That's why Swadhyaya is part of deity worship. You can't be a good pujari unless you study and know the philosophy and deal with devotees and associate and follow the temple, you know, like the whole program. Otherwise, you actually can't be a good pujari. You know, you may be good at, you know, dressing the deities or waving the incense, but you're not actually what the Pancharatra calls a pujari.
Entering the mood.
Yeah, because you missed the mood. Yes, you know the technicalities and not know the function, purpose. Like that. Like, you're fine. These books here, these deity worship books, many devotees will have them, buy them, you know, just to have them. You know, you go to most temples, every pujari department has a set. Generally, no one's ever read. Or they'll look inside, oh, what is this mula mantra, or, you know, just some detail in an artik. They'll just look at this and that. But reading as far as philosophy goes, you know, they won't know. Very rare. I mean, you do find some devotees who very much, they go in and read the whole thing and want to know. But in general, it's not so common. Like that. So they just take some of the ritual. Like that. You know, but in the Vedic concept is, the ritual is taught to the younger children. You know?
That's the technique.
Yeah, the technical thing, how to wave the incense, how to hold the lamp. You know, these kind of things are generally taught when you're younger. Because that side of it, you can grasp then, because you don't have to really intellectualize on it. Then as you get older, then you're taught the philosophy behind it, what's going on, the purposes, philosophy, the meanings, the mood. like that. I mean, some of the mood you can imbibe in the younger, you know, proper attitudes and like that. But the reasons why, that they don't know. You understand? It means you can tell them, don't stand like that, do this, do that, but it's still within the mood of ritual. You know, you stand in artik, you stand nicely, you're sober, you don't talk, you don't laugh, you don't joke. But it's still part of the ritual. But then when they get older, then you get into philosophy. Why you don't? What is the mood? You know, what is the relationship? You know, between the devotee, the Lord, the paraphernalia, like that. Esoteric means the very fine meanings of them, and especially connecting them with the philosophy. Like you can take, if you know all the mantras and know the how to do the worship here, you take all the deity worship mantras and that, and you can give a very nice class. Because the mantras all give very essential points of our philosophy. You know? Understand how the philosophy, when you say philosophy or deity worship, there's the purpose of the deity worship, but then there's the philosophy, the goal of it. You know, how it connects to Krishna. You know? Like we were saying before, is that someone will say, okay, here's these 64 items. Someone will say, well, it's impractical, it's old-fashioned, you know, people don't do it like that, we don't do, I haven't seen anyone do. But the point is that if you know how the Lord's pastimes work, means in the spiritual realm, right? This is working according to that. So this is an esoteric aspect, is that the Lord is you know, received, then he goes for his bath, and then all these kind of more intimate kind of things with devotees, and then he rests a little bit, then more dressed than that, and then he comes back out into the public. This is what goes on in Krishna's Leela. Right? So, but unless you have love for Krishna to take part in that, how are you going to take part? You won't take part. It means those who have pure, unalloyed love for Krishna can take part in that pastime. Right? So how are you going to get yourself from now to there? It means there's a little bit of space in between, isn't it? It means the reality of who I am today and the pure, you know, soul in its pure, unalloyed position, in a spiritual form, you know, reinstated in one's eternal service, serving the Lord, right? There's a little bit of gap, right? So that means you have to fill that gap. So what is that? How is that filled? That is filled by the Pancharatra. The Pancharatra teaches us to engage our conditioned nature directly in the Lord's service. So it gives all the rules, the cult of the culture and all that. But behind that, there's a whole philosophy. It means, why is it picked like this? Why are the rules done like this? Because this is what goes on there. But it's made into the form of rules and presented in a very neutral way so that the devotees can follow it. Same time the karmis, the jnanis, the yogis, the bogies, and you know, everybody else, they can all follow it. And because they follow the Lord's rules, they make some advancement. You know, at least in piety. And if they're sincere, then they'll come in contact with a devotee who will tell them the actual purpose, the essence, devotional service. But at least, it's just like, if I'm doing the right activity with the wrong mood, now which is easier? I'm doing the wrong activity in the wrong mood, or I'm doing the right activity in the wrong mood, which is going to be easier to correct?
Adjust the mood.
Yeah, all you have to do is adjust the mood and bingo, you have it. Somebody's learned all the culture and everything like this and that, but doesn't know Krishna's God. You tell him Krishna's God, bingo, you have right there someone who knows Krishna consciousness, the philosophy and the culture already. That's how you get in the Bhagavatam and these other stories where someone will go along, like Prachina Barhishat. Gross materialist. Gross materialist. Narad Muni comes and sits with him one sitting. Bang! Makes him into a devotee. Because he already had all the culture. Means he respected the Brahmins, that the Brahmins, what they say is correct, and these Brahmins told him karmakanda is the thing to do. He was doing it with full faith. Then when Narad Muni told him that, no, this is, there's higher than that, the point of having full faith remained, you know, in the Acharya. And now it shifted to, instead of the materialistic Brahmins, to the pure devotee of the Lord. Right? And the ability to control his senses, because to do karmakanda and all that, you have to control your senses. But now he's controlling for Krishna instead of for sense gratification. So therefore he was able to leave his kingdom, everything, and then go. So that's why you see in one conversation people surrender and become great devotees like that, because they already are following the culture, everything. That's why Prabhupada says that the Kali Bhakta, the one who's worshipping, you know, Durga, Mother Kali, is better situated than someone who's following a non-Vedic religious practice. Because then, not only do they not know the philosophy and the wrong mood, but they don't even know the culture or the ritual, anything. But here you have somebody who's following the Vedic principles, though his motive and his goal is wrong. So you just change that, and then bingo, you know, you have it. Because they're following closely. That's why Prabhupada would emphasize so much and talk so much about Vedic culture. But he didn't mean the Vedic culture in the mood of the karmis, in the mood of the jnanis, or in the mood of the yogis, but in the mood of the devotee. And so therefore, because there are some rituals that are important. If you're a karmakandi, there's some rituals that are especially meant for you. That a jnani has other ones. He doesn't have to follow ones the karmakandi does. And then the yogi, he has some other ones. Right? But the devotee then doesn't do certain aspects that they do. But the essential principles are all the same. You'll see for anyone, respective authority is always there. Doesn't matter what function within the Vedic culture is there. What is your deity? What is your process? That principle will always be there. Because you have to be able to accept Krishna as the ultimate authority. And you have to be able to accept those who come in the line from the Lord as the authority. And they're the process through which you're going to get. In other words, parampara. So these principles are never, never compromised. Never. Though they may change the form of it to fit the various material mentality. Does that make some sense? So what we have to do is understand that the Vedic culture, there's basically one culture, but it has manifold aspects. So one has to hear from the acharyas and learn from them what we take from there and how we apply it in the mood. Otherwise, if we just take the ritual and not the mood, then it may end up as another culture. Because the principle, like even in the Western culture, if you go back a little bit in time, you should listen to your parents, you should respect your teachers and other elders and all that. So it's there, but the flavor is totally different. So the principle remains, but its application is totally different. You understand? Because of their motive. Okay, so we'll end here. Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare